The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there are euphemisms for many things that are unpleasant. And there's a euphemism that we're seeing coming out of the Federal Reserve called quantitative easing. And somehow it creates euphoria in the markets. I'm just wondering, is that a euphemism for something pleasant or is it unpleasant?
Well, listen, the way you use language or sometimes couch a certain term makes you feel better for a certain period of time.
Right.
The idea of being reorganized or a reorganization that a company may go through entails many pink slips, and that's not necessarily a good thing if you're on the receiving end of a pink slip.
Right.
But it feels better if you've just been a part of the reorganization. And, you know, when you look at something like quantitative easing, you can get lost in the language. Very simply, it's money printing. QE is simply money printing. Euphemisms change the feel and frankly, sometimes confuse the issue, but it is simply creating money, and in this case, credit, out of nothing to use for a stated purpose. And again, some would like to call it QE3.
Well, and I've actually heard QE infinity at this point, because they didn't really, there were no limits on this one. It's just, let's go ahead and do, what do you need?
That's what sets it apart from QE1 and QE2, is that it's indefinite in nature.
Yeah.
And the mortgage-backed securities, which they're talking about purchasing $40 billion each month, this is, again, purchases per month, with no timetable given for a wrap-up. Annualized, that's $480 billion a year.
And that's just in mortgages, not counting the other things that they're buying, like the treasuries and what have you.
Well, and that would be a holdover from Operation Twist.
Right.
You look at that $480 billion a year, and without a time frame, we really have big numbers in play. Is that the way we should read it, $480 billion a year? Or is it trillions, essentially money printing on an unlimited scale and for an indefinite time frame? And this is really the sign of the times. The sign of the times for us looks like the number 8, which has just fallen on its side. Kevin, you just mentioned infinity and QE to infinity. That is the sign of the times.
Well, you know, and when the announcement was made last week, I couldn't help but sing the Candyman, you know, because the Candyman was giving candy to all the kids. You can even eat the dishes. I mean, he just makes everything tasty and delicious. The problem is food prices, okay? And we can talk about that maybe later, but when people go hungry because of QE3 or QE infinity, it's going to be a different story, isn't it?
Yeah, now you're talking about a very tangible outcome of money printing. And of course, there's other things that go into that. And there are consequences of note, that being one of them. And of course, asset classes, which will benefit, and some, of course, which may suffer as well.
Mm-hmm.
We and the marketplace are no longer speculating over the European Central Bank and the Fed's announcements. Instead, now we need to consider the course that we're likely to be on over the next 12 to 24 months.
Well, David, what else can they announce? Once you've said, all right, I'm going to give you everything that you need without limit, I mean, what else is there? Is there another announcement that's just waiting in the wings?
Well, the challenge is that both these central banks face is any wow factor from future announcements is nearly impossible.
Right.
As indefinite and unlimited, you put those in quotes, indefinite and unlimited promises have already been put on the table. And frankly, what's curious, because we're seeing some improvement in economic figures, why were these commitments, again, indefinite and unlimited, why were they made now?
Well, let me ask you, were they seeing something that maybe is not in print right now? I mean, we had the Jackson Hole meeting. What was said behind closed doors, and what were the numbers really that they were looking at? Not the massage numbers, not the seasonally adjusted numbers, and all the different ways that they approach the numbers differently with us than they do themselves. Is there something that they saw that scared them?
Frankly, I think that's exactly the case. Data would need to be looking pretty grim for them to take this kind of measure at this point.
Right.
Because again, I mean, the employment number actually improved this last time. We've gone from 8.3 to 8.1. We've got a number of things which you could argue, I mean, again, just depending on your perspective, indicate progress in terms of recovery. We might take a slightly different view or interpretation to those facts, but I think they were looking at data that would not be the kind of thing that you would want to go to press with and would not be sort of dinner party banter. This is, again, the group would need to be macabre if you're really interested in what they were probably looking at. The ECRI, the Economic Cycle Research Institute, Kevin, they put together data and have long influenced and informed the direction of the Fed.
Well, isn't the founder of the ECRI the professor who taught Alan Greenspan what he knows?
Yeah, there is sort of this lineage, if you will, between the ECRI through Greenspan to the Fed and that lingering influence. They would say that we've been in recession starting in June.
Wait a second. Now, the Federal Reserve is not saying this. The Federal Reserve says we're still in an expansion or a recovery. But behind closed doors, are they accepting that there's a recession again?
This is my point. We'll wait another 6 to 12 months to see what the National Bureau of Economic Research says about whether or not we are, in fact, in recession. But from the ECRI to the Fed, it's already been stated. We've been in recession since June. Now, these are not very well-published numbers, and for obvious reasons. Again, this is not the kind of thing that you want to bring up at a dinner party. It's a bit of a downer. What do you do for an encore? And this is really the question we're asking. The Fed would need to have very good reason to sort of throw everything they can at the market. And again, you may say $40 billion, that's not throwing everything at the market.
Right.
But by making it an indefinite and by not putting a cap, you basically have trillions, potentially, in the pipeline. And that, again, needs to be clarified. We're not talking about some strange magic. It just is simply money printing.
Well, and David, doesn't it put pressure on every other central bank in the world to also print money? Because, you know, if we're going to be printing money and devaluing the dollar, we've talked about competitive devaluation worldwide. Other countries can't compete if their currencies stay strong. So what about China? What about the European Central Bank? Does that mean loosening or loose policy for those banks as well?
You do have competition on the downside, and that's where you have sort of competitive devaluations. Talked about that many times, and in many contexts, you can discuss it theoretically, but we have that in real time today. So again, if you look at sort of risk mitigation and risk management, if the Fed is doing what they're doing now, as of last week, right, with this third QE or QE infinity, as we'll call it from now on, what do you do for an encore? You've played your best tunes. You've already come out on stage and played again and again. You don't have anything except the oldies, and they're all used up. No one really likes them anymore. What do you play as a musician when you're out on stage for that last encore? They have nothing.
Is this a sign that we're coming into the end game? I mean, is this an end game move where they're saying, look, it's all or nothing?
Sure. We're moving towards checkmate for both the Fed and the ECB.
Well, then let me ask you, what is the market response to this? Does the market sense that we have a long-term gain here, or have they already factored it into the price?
No, the market thinks in nanoseconds, and basically you've had positive initial moves higher in the equity markets. You know, they seem to lack any follow through at this point. So again, one day wonder, great move, but frankly, 1,000 to 1,500 points of the recent gains were quantitative easing in anticipation.
That was already priced in.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the last several weeks finally saw precious metals and other commodities move higher, reflecting the Fed's decision to print. Again, is this rising tides lifting all boats? And this is where we'd suggest not for long, in our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We will discuss this later as we consider the various drivers of other commodities, but there is a difference between the industrial commodities, between the ags, between precious metals, and what ultimately is driving them. I'll refer back to the panel discussion I sat on in January for The Economist magazine's intelligence unit, discussing what we saw then and now have even more confirmation of in terms of these various commodity segments.
And so, in other words, you want to be very careful as you're looking at various commodities. You can't just say, well, it's going to be inflation to the moon at this point, so everything's going to rise. Not necessarily, because we also have slowdowns of consumption. We have slowdowns of production that have to be factored into certain commodities.
Now, the question of what this really signifies, the Fed taking action, is that the jobs picture is worse than the numbers imply, in part because of the duration of unemployment. And I think this is a critical variable. It's the longest duration on record of people who have become unemployed and remain unemployed. Obviously, going back to the Great Depression, there was more people unemployed then, but actually for a shorter period of time. You can argue correctly that the real world numbers today exceed 15%. Again,
well, because a lot of those unemployed drop off the list after a year, don't they?
Exactly. And that's the difference between U3 and U6. We would agree with that. But the larger issue is the time spent out of work. And this is where we're setting records in this particular period, this greater recession today.
Well, David, we've talked with a number of people. John Taylor, we've talked to some top advisors to the Federal Reserve who say that the dual mandate for the Fed is a death mandate for the Fed. In other words, they're supposed to control inflation by creating money or contracting the money supply, you know, through interest rates, what have you. But they're not supposed to really tap into fiscal policy, what the government should be doing. But the dual mandate came in the late 70s saying, yes, we also want to make sure that you guys control employment and make sure that the unemployment level stays low.
I'm not so sure that Congress in the 1970s wasn't looking for a scapegoat. If it didn't work, they couldn't be voted out, but they could at least say, hey, we've done our part, but listen, it was monetary policy really messed things up here, and they're supposed to be looking at employment as well. They haven't done their job.
I guess the problem, though, Dave, is what if you have inflation concerns right there looming in front of you, and you have high unemployment? What do you do when you're the Federal Reserve and you have both mandates, and they're saying no high inflation and no high unemployment?
Right. Well, this is where I think Congress is being judged and found wanting by the Fed. They, I believe, see Congress as doing little, too little, and perhaps too late. Therefore, the Fed sees its role and the need to move squarely into the midst of the fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. Again, this is the second mandate of the Fed. It's always been the more troublesome of the two. In our opinion, it's the one dealing with employment, which is an obvious political issue being dealt with by a supposedly neutral and non-politicized group. But you can't have that. You can't be dealing with employment issues and not be in that fiscal context.
Right.
So the independence of the Fed is not supposed to cross the line into politics, but fixating on that second mandate blurs the lines between congressional fiscal policy and Fed monetary policy on the other hand.
You know, David, this reminds me of what we're seeing in Europe right now. Okay, you've got a European Central Bank that basically says, you know, we're going to have a monetary system, but we're going to let you guys do your own fiscal stuff. The problem is, when you have to merge the two, which is what's going on in Europe, it creates a lot of confusion, and it actually creates a real confusion also as to who controls what when. Nobody really takes the blame for anything, and no one really solves anything either.
Now, we like the Germans' classical position, which is that inflation is the primary concern of the body controlling the printing presses. They were not always so vigilant. If you look back at German history and Haverstein's dream or nightmare, however you prefer to look at it,
right,
they learned the hard way that a central bank does best with a singular focus.
Well, and of course, you're mentioning what you're talking about is the hyperinflation in Germany in the early 1920s.
Right. So the fact that they have a singular mandate and don't focus on employment or on the fiscal side, listen, there is a reason for it. Mm-hmm. There is a reason for it, and we would do well to learn from it. Because, Kevin, this is one of the most disturbing elements of what was announced last week. The idea that they would keep rates too low too long and keep too much juice in the system too long. They would err on that side. Bernanke said as much. We will overstay our welcome in terms of stimulus. We want to make sure we get out of this. But again, I ask the question, what does that say? What does that say about what nightmarish scenarios the Fed is looking down the path to see that they would make this now and not make it a responsive action? This is being progressive, getting out in front of a crisis. We don't have anything in the headlines now that would imply that there is an implosion in the financial system, and yet the actions that they're taking would imply that they see something of that caliber on the horizon. Why? Because you're using up your last bit of ammunition.
Well, and the problem is, when you run out of ammunition, don't you have just a sudden, horrible shift in interest rates, making our national debt, our private debt, everything unaffordable almost instantly because the interest rates have been artificially held low for too long?
Yeah, so I mean, the last thing which the Fed's decision signifies is that the financial and economic endgame is on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
I'd suggest that between 36 and 48 months from now, we will have cycled through, in fact, encountered and worked our way partially, if not completely through, a collapse in the bond market, a major move lower in the U.S. dollar, with the consequences of these particular market machinations being most grave.
Well, and David, I've got to bring into this, we can talk about markets all we want, and there's a lot of people who listen who say, you know, I'm really not the markets. I own some gold, I own some cash. How does that really affect me? But the middle class, they're the ones who've really paid the price so far on this, and it sounds like they're going to continue to pay the price.
Well, and some have and some have not. The middle class participation in the Great Recession has been felt dramatically by the ranks of the newly unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
and not at all by those still with a job. So you've got sector-specific and geographic-specific unemployment issues, which are acute, which are very painful, not to minimize them at all. But we're still at tolerable levels. I say tolerable because we have yet to see the riots and protests domestically on the scale that Europe and other developing countries have to date, as and when the U3 number, not U6, but U3, the smaller, more distorted number, now about 8.1%, as and when that exceeds 15%, that will change, along with a dramatic change in social mood amongst rich and poor. You're seeing that contrast played out, but it's largely because of political antics. You've got the Republicans and the Democrats playing off against the rich and the poor, and had this great contrast between the two parties. The reality, Kevin, is we will see the social mood driving that, not the media and political banter driving that, as in when we get above that 15% number.
You know, David, you talk about no riots right now, but CSI, the Complex Systems Institute in Cambridge, has said that we're only about a year away from global food riots based on what we're seeing here. So the time bomb is ticking, according to complexity science and the people who are looking at more than just one variable.
Well, and I think it's important to note that when you look at the budget, this is the end of a four-year spending term, and this is very important to note. Historically, you get a lot of spending, a lot of government spending the last year of an election cycle. Why? I wonder why.
Have we ever seen it not be that?
What have you done for me lately? You need to have a very tangible remembrance of what the party in power has just done for you this year. And so you generally see a peak in government spending in the last year of a presidential cycle. Now, what that implies is that moving into 2013, government spending is a bit of a restart. So not only the fiscal cliff, but natural budgeting is going to be skinnier as we move into 2013. And with that, you can assume a much lower economy. Kevin, you look at 2013, and I think people are going to remember the 13 in 2013 as something like a Friday event, the kind of 13 that you don't like and is a little bit gory.
So a lot of people are going to wish that the Earth did end on 12/21/12, you know, as we go into 13. Well, okay, but the consequence is already being felt in the dollar. You travel the world, you know what these trips are starting to cost you because of just the decline in the dollar just recently.
What was interesting is my dad and I were talking about this just in recent days, where compared to the euro, 6-7% decline in the US dollar from recent highs, right. But the decline is more dramatic when you look at off-grid currencies. If you're talking about the Filipino currency, if you're talking about the Indonesian currency,
right.
And of course, this means a lot to my dad for obvious reasons.
Well, because of the orphanages. I mean, you have U.S. dollars going in to help support these orphanages in Indonesia and in the Philippines and in India. And if currency isn't keeping up, then they're buying less and less rice with U.S. dollars converted to their currency.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, and ironically, rates across the board have also moved higher.
You're talking interest rates.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, this is a consequence of bonds being sold and risk assets being purchased, which the Fed, of course, seems to be confused over. On the one hand, they want to hold rates lower, allowing for what, in their view, will be a complete recovery in housing and sort of a quiet subsidy to the banking sector. On the other hand, they want to improve asset values and create a wealth effect, thereby emboldening consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So we did see the one-day move higher in equity prices on Friday, yet rates are moving higher as well, contradicting the stated purpose, which is actually to bring rates lower and support that return to growth in housing.
Okay, now we've been talking about currencies, and we've been talking about different valuations for currencies, interest rates, but there's still the real thing, okay? The real thing is the commodity market. You said you would talk about that a little bit, because not all commodities behave the same all the time.
Yeah, I think this is an area where confusion abounds. While the dollar cost of commodities is rising in the face of a dollar purchasing power being diminished, good old supply and demand is ever the larger factor in commodity pricing. And
right.
this is what you have to remember. Supply and demand fundamentals only take a back seat to currency devaluation when devaluation is in that super or hyper mode.
So like a hyperinflation, it doesn't matter what the demand is. Everything goes up.
Everything goes up. Again, that's the crack-up boom of von Mises language. And what we don't have is a crack-up boom today. Mm-hmm. What we do have is the potential for supply and demand destruction in certain areas of the commodities space while you've got massive demand increases and limited supply availability in others.
So you have to look at each commodity, each one specifically, and determine what the supply and demand factors are as they go into the pricing.
Right. So you're really contrasting the industrial commodities, the ags, and then sort of a third category, the precious metals,
right,
which have demand dynamics which are not always economically dependent. In other words, they can be non-correlated or negatively correlated. And again, this is back to the gist of the work that we did with Economist Magazine earlier this year. The ags, of course, demand is relatively constant because people eat the stuff, and there's not that many alternatives. I mean, if you're used to eating rice, it's not like you can just switch to, well, what is equally available and abundant when you're going to the store. Rice is rice is rice. You need it. If it goes up, you get angry and you march on the streets. Same with corn and wheat primarily. You know, soybeans to a degree as well. But those have relatively constant demand, and what impacts the price is supply. Supply disruption, and of course this year is a classic case in point with as much weather as we've had. Now you can have that exacerbated by, again, currency devaluation. But again, that's a thin layer of influence. Supply and demand is still one of those two variables. Supply on the one hand or demand on the other is still the critical element. Now, going back to the industrials are very much demand dependent. This is, I think, one of the things that people neglect is that we've had a huge growth in supply over the last 5 to 7 years.
Because of China.
To meet demand, growing demand in China.
Right, right.
So actually, we went from very low supplies and sort of stagnant research and development projects, if you want to put it in those terms, or just go dig in the dirt and find new stuff projects by a lot of your major miners. They've changed that over the last 5 to 7 years. They've brought a tremendous amount of supply online, whether you talk about iron ore or aluminum or copper. And guess what? Now they've got an overabundance of supply and demand is beginning to wane. So you've got the worst of both worlds, oversupply and under demand. That's why we see some vulnerability with the industrials.
Well, and David, you talked to Michael Pettis when you were in China, and you know, he writes that there's something coming because of China that's really fascinating, and that is there's a lot of demand right now being utilized by China for infrastructure and building and that type of thing. So it's honest-to-goodness demand. But they're also hoarding. They're building a supply or an inventory of these commodities, and at the point that they stop building that inventory, okay, if their demand slows down because their economy slowing, and they have a huge overhang of inventory, not only does it cut out the normal supply, but there's no need for them to buy anything else for years.
That's right. Well, Kevin, next week we're releasing the second part of our DVD series, the film series this year, and it is on Asia, and this is one of the issues that we deal with. So sort of as a preview of coming attractions, what a lot of your Chinese firms have been doing in stockpiling or creating large inventories of commodities, they've been creating these large inventories and then borrowing against them. So they're leveraged, and that, I think, is an element which is important, because when you begin to compromise the balance sheet by coexisting debt with equity, in the case of a large inventory on the one hand and debt set against it, now all of a sudden price volatility at all puts you in a much more precarious position in terms of your balance sheet.
You're running a dangerous game is what you're doing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So it's not just a question of buying it because they think the price is going to go up and they therefore want to buy it cheap to be able to use it and have a lower cost basis. They're actually borrowing and getting ready cash from that stockpile. Now, they're doing that with heavy equipment and some other things too, but we cover that in detail in the second segment of the film, which you can watch online here in the next 10 days.
Well, David, shifting the gears here, I know you're just getting back, and so you've got a whole week worth of appointments with clients who are wanting you to look at their stock portfolios. The stock market. Let's just talk about the stock market for a moment here. We've talked about commodities and currencies, interest rates, but I'd like to hear about stocks and bonds, because is it something that's trading right now? Is the market something that's trading on fundamentals? Is it hopeful for higher profits and cash flow? Or is this something that is just trading on wishful thinking from the Fed?
Yeah, stocks are not trading on economic fundamentals. They don't reflect the business environment that we're in today. They do reflect the promise of promiscuous liquidity flows from the Fed and from the ECB.
Which the Fed has already promised that.
Exactly. How much money do you want? You can have it. How much more? You can have that too. And they're not alone. It's the ECB. It's the BOJ, the Bank of Japan. It is the PBOC to a lesser degree. They haven't promised anything big lightly. And what we see is central banks doing the same thing in concert, and it's distorted pricing. It's distorted expectations. And frankly, it's made the stock market a very dangerous place to be. Dangerous in the sense that, you know, when you look at earnings, Earnings are interestingly at all-time highs.
Right.
Now, when earnings are at all-time highs, there are a couple of things of note. You can say, okay, they're at all-time highs and going higher.
You would say that's a reason to own anyway, but you would also say, my gosh, if they're at all-time highs, what else can we be given on that front as well?
And the question, too, is how did we get here?
Yeah.
So part of it is productivity gains. A part of it is restructuring the balance sheet, eliminating equity, and adding more debt at these low, low levels. So again, you retire a part of your equity, and if that increases your earnings per share considerably, when you're taking millions and millions and millions of shares off the market, now your earnings on a per share basis divided by a smaller number of shares has just improved dramatically too. So there are elements in which we are here on an engineered basis, both by the CFOs of various Fortune 500 companies, but also the financial engineering directly from our central banks.
So as long as that engineering, that artificial element continues to work, then the stock market may continue to stay up. But just like we talked about with the bond market, and I want to move to bonds in just a second, but just like we talked about with the bond market, at some point we could have an instantaneous repricing, like a one-day event, if the artificial stimulation isn't working.
Well, and that's what we saw just in recent days with the oil market. A one day, actually a 3-minute collapse in the price of oil. And why? It was because a computer read the wrong 3 letters and implied that there was going to be a release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Yeah.
Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPR, those 3 letters were somewhere in the internet ether. And this particular algorithm, this computer, read SPR, got ahead of itself and started liquidating oil contracts, liquidating oil contracts, liquidating oil contracts, and that fit on itself.
Well, David,
this is a frail market. There's no mind behind it. It's pre-programmed. It's autopilot moving towards a set of mountains, not realizing that an adjustment, somebody needs to take the control.
It's an algorithm. And actually, the algorithms are controlled by the guy who controls the news. Okay. Bloomberg is the one that sells a lot of these investment algorithms to the investment firms that read that thing wrong. These computers are cycling through the news and continuing to buy or sell based on what the algorithm says is either positive or negative for that market. Now, how many people who just have a family and want to have a savings account so that they can have retirement, how can they compete with that?
Can't compete. Can't compete at all. That's one of the reasons why you're seeing mass exodus from the equities markets, because people just say, listen, it's not only for the professionals anymore.
Right.
It's for the professionals with supercomputers. If you don't own a supercomputer, how can you compete? That's not altogether true, but certainly there is an element of it where you're at a disadvantage if you're a day trader against the supercomputers.
Okay, so let's say I'm a guy who says I don't want stocks right now. Okay, I'm going to move into bonds. That's the traditional move from a person who says no more equities for me. I'm just going to go ahead and get some guaranteed interest.
And I think the only way of knowing if we've already passed the turning point in the bond market with rates going higher and bond prices coming down considerably, I guess we'll know that turning point after the fact as we're looking at it in the rearview mirror. What we are comfortable saying is that in light of the indefinite commitments, those sort of infinite commitments from the Fed, that we are comfortable saying that by 2016, we will see a bond market collapse in the U.S.
Right.
Now, the dollar, of course, is a different story, but a similar story. The downtrend has resumed. This is consistent with the last QEs. Again, we had quantitative easing 1 and quantitative easing 2. The dollar took it on the chin both times. Equity markets rallied 20-25% in light of the Fed infusion. Of course, we had the pre-rally, you could call it, getting us to 13 and change already. So we don't know whether we'll see another 20-25%, because remember that QE 1 and QE 2 came at a time when the equity prices were down 15-20%.
Right.
And so there was a recovery fomented by the initiation of QE 1 and QE 2. In this case, there was no down day in the equity market. There was no sort of recovery story that was needed. We were 13.3, 13.4 on the Dow when this was announced. So where do we go from here? It's just more money in the system.
And David, you know, we've talked about all these different investment categories except for money itself. Okay. Now, when you create QE, that's really not good for your money, is it?
Well, it's not good for any of the money that was existent before that point in time. So if you're a cash holder,
right,
and there's more money printed, you've just seen the value of your money diminished because of the dilution dilution. There's now more of it, and it's worth less as a consequence. So what we have is this promise last Friday of an infinite commitment to recovery. Now, while that's impressive, and I appreciate the thought and the feelings behind that, what we really need to be concerned with is the knock-on effects of too much money printing. And what we will see, what we're likely to see over the next 2 to 3 years, is a continued growth phase in the precious metals market, a continued decline in the U.S. dollar, and really this precarious place of the stock market not behaving on the basis of economic fundamentals. Ultimately, it's not the number of widgets that are being sold, but it's the kind of financial engineering that is allowed through low interest rates and infinite liquidity. Is that what you're betting on when you buy a Kraft, a General Mills, and Illinois Tool Works? Don't you really want to buy a trend in the larger economy, which is a growth-oriented trend, where you know that you know that you know that consumers are back? This is really where we're dealing with artificial realities. It's a very dangerous place out there.
Well, David, you just walked in from about a 10-day vacation with your family. I know you were with your father and your mom, as well as the rest of your family. You had a handful of financial newspapers that you got while you were there, and you had completely marked up. There were a couple of articles that you threw in front of me just as I was sitting here waiting to record. Do you want to mention those?
Well, I have to. Yeah. I have to, because take the time, if you're listening to this, take the time to read these articles. One is in the weekend edition of the Financial Times, and it's by John Authors. The title of it is Fed Sets Its Sights on Infinity and Beyond. And one of the things that you'll notice is a chart which prices the S&P 500 now at all-time highs in nominal terms and prices it in gold terms down 61% from peak prices. Just to say, what is the reality we're dealing with here? But I think John Authors does a good job identifying some of the fundamental concerns that I have, that we share as a firm, about the Fed's activity and central bank activity today. The second article...
Well, that was the Wall Street Journal article that was written partially by one of our guests, Taylor.
Exactly. This is a John Taylor article, George Shultz, Michael Boskin, John Kogan, Alan Meltzer, and then again, John Taylor. The Magnitude of the Mess We're In is the title. The Magnitude of the Mess We're In, Monday, September 17th, the Wall Street Journal.
Don't read it before bed.
No, I wouldn't, because, you know, frankly, what they're doing is bringing to a larger public conversation things that we've been discussing here on the program for the last 6 to 12 months. And I look at this and I say, okay, great. Now you know. Now you know the direction of gold. Because if I were reading this article and was a naysayer about owning precious metals in this environment, do you know what I would be doing right now? This has the imprint, the imprimatur of the elite in terms of the academic elite. These are the establishment.
These are presidential advisors.
And what you have is the elite saying to the elite, we know what lies ahead. This is ugly. If you want to know the debt picture for the United States, if you think it's bad, forget about it. It's far worse than you can even imagine. So essentially what you have in the announcement on Friday from Ben Bernanke, QE Infinity, is the future course for precious metals for at least the next 2 to 3 years, or until they change course. That's very interesting and cannot be ignored.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.